I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. When Fred Boyce was still a baby, his mother left him alone in her Boston apartment, and so the police took him away. For the next 6 years, Fred was bounced from foster homes in Southeastern to Hingham to Dedham to Merrimack, and finally, at age 7, this frightened little boy was given an intelligence test and, based on those results, was sent to live in the Walter E. Fernald Home for the Feeble-Minded. Fred was one of many others. Throughout much of the 20th century, hundreds of thousands of children like Fred Boyce were regarded as defective and locked away, their case files marked with words like idiot, moron, imbecile. This hour, we'll talk with Fred Boyce and the man who tells his story in a new book called State Boys Rebellion. We'd like to have you join our conversation. Do you have any of your own memories of those days when children were just locked away like that? And is it reasonable to say that America has moved on beyond the days of institutional abuse, or does it still continue? Our number's 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. In just a moment, we will meet Michael D'Antonio. He's a Pulitzer Prize-winning writer and author of this new book, State Boys Rebellion. But I want to start with Fred Boyce, who was himself one of those so-called state boys from the age of 7 all the way up to 19. He's with us on the line. Hello, Fred.
Hi, Dick. How are you?
I'm fine.
Thanks for having me on.
Well, it's good of you to join us. I'm fascinated to know if you have any memory, Fred, of that first day when at age 7 you first stepped inside the boys' dormitory at the Fernald School.
Well, I can just tell you, I was just a frightened little kid, to say the least. I was just terrified because the big doors and the big building and all the other kids in there, they had 105 kids to this one building. It was 30 kids to a ward with the beds 6 inches apart, and you'd sit on these settees and fold your arms for hours, and it was just such a frightening, just total frightening.
Did it feel like a prison?
Pardon me?
Did it feel like a prison?
Well, I did not distinguish what a prison was like. I was 7 years old, but thinking of it today, it was like a prison without bars. Even though it didn't have bars on the buildings I was in, you were constantly monitored, and everything you were told to do, you were just told to do regimentally everything. And of course the doors were locked. You couldn't go out or anything without an attendant with you, and so forth. And so it had all the earmarks of a prison, to say the least.
And those attendants, some of them were pretty rough on you. The fellow James McGinn is one whose name and whose behavior stands out. What was he like?
Well, he was a terrifying man most of the times when he was on. We used to just try to figure out when he'd be off so that we could have a peace of mind, because he would just come up with these degraded type of abuses to do with kids, like in the book where they had me one time I was caught talking in the dining room to one of the other kids, and I had to go up onto the floor, and he'd roll a little piece of bread into a dough roll, Paul, and put it on the floor and make you kneel down with your head down to it, and take your nose and roll it around while we were waiting for the attendants to get back from their lunch. And of course, it was so humiliating with all the other kids, 105 other kids in there watching it, you know. That was just one of the things, but he did plenty, you know. Just a terrifying situation. I'm so glad that the story is coming out and the public is believing it now.
Fred, the names that you and the other boys were called, retards, morons, you're so young when this happens. I'm wondering if when you look back on it now, you imagine or think, you know, was there a time when you thought, wow, maybe I am a moron, or maybe I'm not fit to be out in society with other people?
Yes. Matter of fact, for many years while we were there, when we were younger, we would believe that something was wrong with us. We were not a member of the species, of the human species. We were from another planet, and we must have done something, but we just couldn't figure out what it was. And as we got older, we'd start questioning. That's when the rebellion came in. We'd start questioning them. Why are we here? And why do we have to be, you know, watched after so carefully and everything, you know? Of course, we were among mentally challenged children, so obviously they had to be careful with them, you know. Of course, it wasn't a place for anybody, not even the mentally challenged. But the point is that we had to go with the same regimentation as the retarded kids would have. For an example, in school, you know, we were reading Dick and Jane books until we were 18 years old, practically, because they didn't have it set up so that you could advance, because they had to take the lowest group, which was the mentally challenged, and until they caught up with us.
Now, Fred, some of our listeners may recall the news that came out about the radioactive experiment in which a number of the boys were fed radioactive porridge at the Fernald School for the Feeble-Minded. You were one of those kids. Do you remember that?
Yeah, I remember. You know, it's funny because it was over 50 years ago, and, you know, we had oatmeal every single day there anyways, you know. But, yeah, they put us in a special ward, and we had to wear these nightgowns, and they would check our blood and our stew after they gave us the oatmeal to eat, you know, after it was sprinkled with this radioactive particles. And I often say, you know, a lot of times when we were in there, I'd take a spoonful of when they weren't looking and put it into the next kid's dish. And I'd kind of say, like, Mikey likes it, you know. It was a horrible tasting thing, food. But it was a class out in Oregon that I speak to do an interview every year, and they asked me, they said, Fred, do you like oatmeal, you know, after all this? And I tell them, I said, I eat that stuff till it comes out my ears. I still like that stuff. As long as they don't sprinkle it with any radioactive fallout or anything, it's okay.
Fred, hang on just half a second, because I'd like to bring the author, Michael D'Antonio, in on the program here. The name of Michael's book, I remind you, is State Boys Rebellion. Fred is one of these state boys. And Michael, welcome to the program.
Good morning, Dick.
Thanks for your patience here. It was, in fact, that exposure to radioactivity that brought you from other work that you've been doing to this story of Fred Boyce and the others, right?
That's right. In the mid-90s, the government admitted that they had conducted a series of experiments on civilians involving radiation during the Cold War. And the Science Club, as it was called at the Fernald School, was one of the more egregious examples. You know, it's hard to believe today, but in that era, national security justified in the minds of government officials using kids and institutions as human guinea pigs. And I had done a book on environmental experiments, and when this news came out, was introduced to Fred and some of the other former Fernald boys, and they were members of the Science Club, and they were pursuing a lawsuit to get some kind of justice.
But the use and the abuse of institutionalized people was, and you point this out in the book, something that was really easy to do then, because society had made this appalling classification about the worth of these boys and girls as humans.
Well, as we often find out, the background to the story is often more interesting than the initial incident. You know, the Science Club was a rather contained project. And yes, it did illustrate the abuse of kids who were most vulnerable. But when I started to ask why these men who, to my mind, were like you and I, there was nothing defective about them, why were they in this big, horrible institution for disabled people, I learned a whole lot more. And it's that national project to improve the gene pool by winnowing out so-called defectives that really appalled me. And to discover that it involved tens of thousands, perhaps hundreds of thousands of kids, and it ran from the 1890s all the way into the 1970s, just amazed me. And that's the origin of the book. And the other part of it, and I hope that listeners don't get too frightened by the tale that's told here, is that these kids were remarkably resilient. And the State Boys' Rebellion isn't about one particular incident. It's about a state of mind. They were rebellious for years, and once they especially became adolescents, they understood there was nothing wrong with them. They didn't know, actually, that the institution itself understood there was nothing wrong, too. There were many within the institution asking, why are these kids here?
I was struck by one of the points that you made early on in the book, Michael, that President Hoover himself, this would have been around 1930, made it clear that the leadership of the land, the White House, was complicit in this sort of forced removal of children. He made a reference to defective children, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes. And this was something that was widely accepted. The Supreme Court ruled in the 1920s that it was legal for states to forcibly sterilize supposedly defective boys and girls. And that was a solution devised when institution directors realized they were running out of bricks and mortar. You know, if you take everyone who supposedly fails an IQ test and lock them away so they won't have children, pretty soon you've got too many children to lock away and not enough beds. So their solution, which sounds awful to us today, was to sterilize them and then release them. Many of these people actually had operations, went on to lead their lives on the outside, and never really understood why they couldn't have children.
And a lot of these kids were rounded up by sort of mobile, I don't know, how do you describe those? I mean, it wasn't just like, you know, the case of Fred Boyce, where, you know, from foster home to foster home, from foster home to the test, and eventually into the institution. Some of these kids were actually sought out by states, right?
True. Almost every state had an agency that would go to public schools and on an annual basis test the children. Those who fell below a certain score were identified for further evaluation. And that was one slippery slope that could lead a kid into institutional life. What's remarkable is that almost from the beginning, there were people questioning the validity of the test. And as we get into the 1940s and 1950s, those voices were sounding very loudly. And yet the inertia of this process was so powerful that it didn't stop.
So when were the last of these institutions finally closed down?
Well, we all know that deinstitutionalization really gained steam in the 60s and early 70s. And I think a lot of us identify with profoundly disabled kids. And we've seen pictures of the inside of institutions and kids who obviously were being neglected and abused. This class of child, the one who some people call the almosts, for almost normal, were neglected by the media and by politicians because they seemed like they were okay in comparison. In fact, as late as the 1970s, Florida had hundreds of these kids locked up. So in a way, they received delayed mercy when compared with kids who were somehow deemed more worthy.
All right, more with Michael D'Antonio, author of The State Boys' Rebellion, when we come back after the break. Fred Boyce is still with us. We'll get a chance to hear more from him about the firsthand account of life in those schools. We'd like to have you join us. Our number's 1-800-423-8255. Is it reasonable to say those kind of social attitudes are now all completely behind us? Do you yourself have any kind of experience with the institutionalization that we're talking about? We'd like to have you in our conversation. We're at 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. With me this hour, Michael D'Antonio. He is the author of The State Boys' Rebellion, joining us from WRHU studios in Hempstead, Long Island. And Fred Boyce, former resident of the Fernald School, who now sells toys and carnival games all along the East Coast, has taken time out of his schedule to join us on the line from Danville, Virginia. Fred is one of the state boys that Michael features in his book. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. We're going to take our first call from Buffalo, New York, and Doug's with us. Hi, Doug.
Hi, Dick. How are you doing today?
I'm well. Thanks for calling.
Yeah. First of all, I'd just like to congratulate Fred on his successful transition into what regular life from what must have been a very harrowing experience at the Fernald School. And my second comment would be to ask Mr. D'Antonio, how did he obtain access to the archives of the Fernald State School. I'm interested in that because I'm developing a museum of disability history for my employer, People Incorporated, here in Buffalo. And I'm getting a lot of the same resistance in terms of access to records and that type of thing.
Michael, why don't you start there?
Sure. Well, I'm glad to hear from Buffalo. There's a wonderful anecdote in the book about a young woman at Fernald who was so rebellious herself that she made it to the Mass Pike, which is Interstate 90, stuck out her thumb, and the next thing you know, she's in Buffalo, where actually she was saved from going back because it turned out that the state of New York wasn't obliged to return her to Massachusetts. So in her mind, Buffalo was the promised land. I had the most success in getting records when I was able to locate state boys and have them file the request for me. States are obliged to turn over the personal records of former patients, and then we had an arrangement where the former patient would then share it with me. The state of Massachusetts also has an archive that's separate from the institution, and it turns out that a great many records were turned over to the state archive. They weren't well regulated, and in a way, I think it's possible that they violated some privacy concerns by turning them over to me. And finally, people who read the book would be amused by the tenacity of some of the former residents. A couple in particular actually used various means to sneak documents out of the institution and share them with me. And, you know, the statute of limitations has run out on those burglaries.
Fred, you were a part of that, right? Fred, you light-fingered a few documents from the...
I take the fifth.
So, I mean, there are many different angles that an investigative journalist might use to get inside. And I find, unfortunately, that states and even the federal government are still very hard to deal with when it comes to even historical documents. I learned recently that the state of Massachusetts is somehow, to some degree, protesting my portrayal of the institution today, even though it's so well documented and former residents and even former staff members have confirmed all the details in the book. They somehow want us to all know that there were good things that happened and continue to happen within the state bureaucracy. And I'm not going to deny that, but I don't think focusing on the two or three good news stories is as helpful to us as understanding the larger problems and how they happened.
I want to take another part of what Doug said at the beginning of his call, and Fred, help me out with this. Doug quite rightly congratulated you for that transition that you made from years in the institution to the life that you lead now. Was it hard?
Yeah, I had to untangle. First, I want to thank Doug for the compliment. It was hard because I had to untangle the damage that they did. They were there to claim it to rehabilitate us, and all they did was just stored our minds and kept us in a lot of fear during that time. And I had to come out and untangle that. I didn't know how to properly ride a bus. I didn't know how to act on what we call it the outside, which was outside the institution, because we were kept in there captive for so long, and we never got to go on the outside, very seldom. And so I had to learn how to act when I got out on the outside. So it was a real challenge.
1-800-423-8255. Next to Boston, and Marcia is joining us. Hi, Marcia.
Hello. This is a question for Fred. I'm curious, when he was institutionalized at age 7, did he have any brothers and sisters in that family that also joined him? Also, in terms of visits, was his mother, I presume she was alive, allowed to visit, or did other relatives visit, and were they aware that he was simply there? Or, you know what I mean? Or was he left completely in isolation?
Fred, go ahead.
Yes, I was completely in isolation until I was like 17 years old. They brought my brother George up to see me just out of the blue. I had no idea he was coming. He came up and I was in the gym playing basketball with the rest of the guys, and all of a sudden I found out I had a brother. And then it started. Then I found out I had other relatives and such. He was in the Division of Little Wanderers and stuff. But no, my mother never did come up, and Bless her heart, she had her own problems, I guess. But
though you did reconnect once you were out?
Yeah, so yeah, once I was out, when I was around 23 years old, George, my brother George, had located me working in this restaurant. I was doing dishes. I was a dishwasher and working the counters. And he had mentioned that my mother lived right across the street in Burbank Street in Back Bay, Boston. He asked me if I'd like to go see her. I said, well, sure, because I was very interested in family, because I never had a family life. And I just felt like, gee, let me find out what this is about, you know. So I did get over to see my mother. And I didn't really have a really emotional, response to it, you know. It was kind of strange, matter of fact, because I'm not having a family for so long and not understanding what a family is and what it means. I kind of didn't know how to identify. It scared me, kind of.
Michael, one of the things that you described from your interviews with some of the other state boys is that moment at the Fernald School when some kids got visitors and some kids didn't. It's just a really heart-wrenching part of the book.
Yes. What's remarkable is the system that they had set up. They had Company Sunday, which was one Sunday per month, and the visiting hours were 4 hours. So you can imagine being a 7 or 8 year old kid, you wait 30 days for that 1 4-hour period. The homeboys, as they were called, had family who might come visit, not always. And the state boys, there were hundreds of them, had no one. And they were confined to the wards when this occurred. Of course, the people who had families, their mothers and fathers or brothers and sisters had very little idea of what was going on in the institution. They were never allowed to visit the wards. If a child complained, it was written off as maladjustment or what do you expect from a defective child. And I think that the other element of this that Fred and some of the other men kind of soft pedal is the degree of abuse that took place. These kids were raped, they were beaten, they were humiliated on a regular basis. The kinds of almost demonic techniques used by these attendants would be crimes today. And they certainly probably were crimes in that day, but they all took place in isolation. You'd have one attendant for 36 kids in a ward not visited by a supervisor on a regular basis. So if they had trouble, the solution was to make an example of the troublemaker. Sometimes they'd use the other boys to set upon the one child who was acting out. So there'd be a beating that would take place, but the attendant wouldn't have to get sweaty or out of breath. He'd have the kids do it for him. So the sense of hopelessness that these kids felt as youngsters and then the defiance that followed is really overwhelming to many readers who have no idea that this kind of thing would have gone on in America in the 1950s.
Fred, do you want to add anything to that?
Well, he articulated that so well, just like he did in the book. I'm just amazed that he articulated our story so explicitly, and he's just a wonderful writer. And I can tell you that that's true, and I could tell you many other stories, too. We couldn't fit it all in the book on the abuse because it was pretty prevalent. But, yeah, and you had to try to survive through it all. You had to just try to figure out who was the bad guys that were. But one thing I wanted to say that's interesting is that when we were kids in there, you had the TV programs. The TV started coming in, so we started to learn a little more about the outside life. And you had Superman, you had the Long Ranger, and it's, a cloud of dust and a hearty high old silver fighting for justice the American way. And we kind of thought that, well, when are these guys going to come and get us, And it was such a fallacy, Because I remember that. I remember saying, gee, look at this, And it was just funny. It's just a strange thing because it was always talking about how wonderful and how justice everything is, and we're waiting for these heroes, superheroes, to come and get us out of here.
We're going to take another call from Boxborough, Massachusetts now. Paul is joining us on the line. Hi, Paul.
Hi. Oh, you want to hear my story?
I do.
Oh, okay. My brother and I was about 6 or 7. My brother's 2 years older. We were in Switzerland. Our parents had come over here, so that was just before the Second World War had broken out. And they put us in a Catholic home for boys up in the mountains.
Were you Swiss or American at the time, Paul?
No, we're Swiss.
Okay.
Yeah. Our parents came over here to get started, and unbeknownst to them, this home turned out to be operated like a concentration camp, because this was sort of the mentality over there. It was from the German section.
How old were you?
I was about 7. I was in there for about 2 years, and my brother was 2 years older. So I was fortunate that I had an older brother look after me.
Were you able to stay in touch with your parents at all during that time, Paul?
Not at all. We were just put in there. And when you were kids, you know, you get put in there and you just wait and do whatever they tell you. And kids ran away through the fields, and they chased after them and dragged them back. And they got beatings for it. We got beat during class and school. They fed us mostly polenta. We never saw any meat. The place used to be heated by wood, and the kids had to go out and hunt through the forest for the wood. We slept in a large dormitory, and it was run by sisters.
You look back at that time now, Paul, and how do you regard it? Do you look back on that angry at the people who treated you the way that you did?
No, I think they were victims of the times, because things in those times were very, what you call, Germanic, and they had a certain attitude as far as kids are concerned. Kids do as I tell you. And you behave yourself. If you didn't, you get cracked. Presents were sent to us on holidays by relatives, and we never saw them. You know, like chocolate and things of this nature. We never saw them because the staff they took them for themselves. So it felt like a concentration camp. Looking back, you had all these boys of various ages, and you just sort of dealt with it.
Paul, I want to thank you for your call and turn, if I can, to Fred Boyce here, because Fred, when I hear you talk about the time, you're not. I mean, you're telling the stories as they happened, and yet I don't hear in your voice anger or bitterness about what happened. Do you agree with Paul to an extent that that was just what was happening back then?
Well, yeah. I mean, I look upon it like an out-of-body experience. I look at it, and I notice this history. It's something I'd like to the public to know so that it doesn't happen again. I am not angry at nobody because I accept life in my own way, and I just feel like, you know, life is not easy. A lot of things happen to people worse than I've ever had, and I count my blessings. And no, I'm not mad at nobody. I think a lot of times there were so many good attendants that were at that Fernal School that came and left real quick when they saw they couldn't do nothing about it. And, you know, they were victims themselves to a point, you know. And I just can tell you that I really think this is something that needs to be told for the history of it and to document it so that it doesn't happen again.
We're going to take a call now from Gloucester, Massachusetts, and Lindy's on the line. Hi, Lindy.
Hi, it's Wendy, actually.
Wendy, hi. Thanks for calling.
Thank you. This is an amazing subject. It's really important that it's coming out. I worked at Fernald from 74 to 80 as a ward attendant, and later went on to Divinity School, where I did a master's thesis on the eugenics movement and the Nazi euthanasia program that was kind of concurrent with it. And just wanted to comment that lots of leading lights were proponents of eugenics, including Margaret Sanger, Oliver Wendell Holmes. In fact, in Stephen Jay Gould's book, The Mismeasure of Man, he talks about a case that Holmes heard, the case of Carrie Buck, who was sterilized without her consent. It's an extremely moving story.
It's actually retold in Michael's book as well.
Yeah, it's a really important story to tell. And I think this stuff is still with us a lot. There's a member of my congregation here in Gloucester who is actually one of the guys who escaped from Fernald. He escaped from the farm at Templeton, which was kind of the out in Western Mass, the rural Fernald. And he escaped in a milk truck and went fishing because he thought that they wouldn't be able to find him if he was at sea. And he's got quite an incredible story. And
Wendy, I have a quick last question for you because we're coming up to a break.
Sure.
You started there in 1974. Was the institution respecting its kids anymore at that time?
Well, there were always people who did. You know, ward attendants. You developed relationships with the residents. But at that time, the consent decree, the court cases were just coming up. And, you know, the seclusion rooms were being unlocked and conditions were being improved. But, you know, the basis that Fernald was started on was, you know, Walter Fernald saying the mentally retarded at large unguarded are a menace to society. So just the fact of the institution and the way it dehumanized people was always huge. Though improvements started happening after the lawsuits came in.
Wendy, thanks so much for calling. We come back after our short break, talk more with Michael D'Antonio and Fred Boyce. The story we're examining is Michael's latest book. It's called The State Boys' Rebellion, story of the children who, for no reason other than the fact that they didn't have a good education or they didn't have enough money or they didn't have parents, were locked away in institutions, in some cases, for their entire childhood. 1-800-423-8255, the number to join us this hour. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. My name is Dick Gordon. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. You're welcome to join my conversation this hour with Fred Boyce, former resident of what was called at the time the Walter E. Fernald School for the Feeble-Minded. Fred left that school when he was 19. He now sells toys and carnival games along the East Coast, and he's with us on the line from Danville, Virginia. Michael D'Antonio is also with us. He is the Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and author of a book called The State Boys' Rebellion. Michael, I wanted to just pick up one thing that Wendy was talking about in her own study of eugenics, because you make that link from the early part of the last century, that it was in fact American thinking and American writing on eugenics that provided inspiration for Adolf Hitler and the Nazis and their notion of a superior race.
That's one of the more startling things I discovered as I started researching the background for Fred's story. At the turn of the century, American science was rather obsessed with improving the national gene pool, and there was a very influential book called The Passing of the Great Race. It was actually written by the president of the Historical Society in New York, and Adolf Hitler later referred to this as his Bible. It inspired his thinking about how to engineer a master race in Germany. He and other Nazi officials hosted American scientists in the years before World War II, and even gave them commendations. So there was this fertilization of ideas that actually went from America to the Third Reich. And there were many British scientists who were also very influential in this. So when one of your callers was speaking about being in a Swiss home,
right,
and being treated with what he considered to be a Germanic influence on child rearing, that might have been part of it, but it also may have been American in its origins as well.
That's a good observation. 1-800-423-8255. To Baton Rouge, Louisiana now, and Mary Beth is with us. Hi, Mary Beth.
Hi, good morning. This is very interesting. I lived 30 years ago next door to a middle-aged man who, this is in a little town, and we didn't grow up there, but we heard that he had been institutionalized years ago, just evidently because he was slow. And I don't know if the family's finances had something to do with it also, but this guy was evidently sprung when his elderly mom was ill and needed him to take care of her. He was functional. He had a driver's license. He was a delivery person in town for the florist. And we heard rumors that he had been castrated. And, you know, we were young and didn't know a lot about it, but he was very nice. He was very gentle, and he had a very high, squeaky voice and, you know, like no hair on his arms, you know, and he was, so we wondered, and now, you know, one of the points that the author made was that sometimes people were sterilized, you know, so they wouldn't breed more, quote, defectives. And now I think, oh, my gosh, that probably really was done.
Let's just check with Michael here. Michael, though you concentrate on the Fernald School, you do sort of cast a wider net around the country. Was this kind of locking away and sterilizing of kids happening in the South, in the West as well?
Oh, yes. It was in, I think, 38 states in all practiced some form of sterilization or sterilization at some level. California actually led the way. I think they had about 40,000 operations done, primarily on Mexican immigrants. There was a very firm racial element to this where the lighter your skin, the less defective you were deemed to be, and the darker your skin, the more defective and undesirable you were. But it was done in the South. Virginia was a place that practiced this quite vigorously. So, and what's interesting to me is that this man's neighbors and the children might have heard something, thought something, probably believed it was too awful to be true. And it was just a scary story. But it turns out that a lot of these scary stories were absolutely true. And in the community of Waltham, where Fernald is located, Fred and I did a program at the public library. There were hundreds of people who turned out. Many of them stood up and said, I was a kid and I was afraid of that place. And I heard this happened and then I heard that happened. And then I read in the book that it was true. So it's remarkable that people sort of knew but couldn't believe it.
To Somerville, Massachusetts now, and Mike's with us. Hi, Mike.
Hello. I worked at Fernald from 1970, started in March of 70. My wife started 6 months before me, and we both worked at the West Building, the oldest building, residential building on the grounds.
Who was in the West Building, Mike?
We had women. It was a whole variety. It was sort of the dead-end building for men. North was the dead-end building.
For women, yeah, north for men.
For men and west for women. And in my wife's ward, the range of intelligence was completely from one end to the other because they needed the higher-functioning women to go ahead and do the work.
And one of the things that Michael says is that during the time that Fred was there, men employees weren't in the women's wards.
Well, the reason I was there, because I was upstairs in the room in the wards where there were behavioral problems, and
right.
I was hired as muscle to restrain and seclude those women. That when they started attacking one another or you know whatever they you know whatever was happening that was assaultive, I came in at like 9 and I left at 6 and I had to tie them or put them in a seclusion room until they calmed down. Sometimes the staffing was so poor that I would come in at 9 and they hadn't even been bathed. Nobody had gotten them up and they were in an incredible uproar because, you know, things were really bad. There was a time also on the experimental level where in the 70s I stopped an experiment because they were trying to test, a hepatitis vaccine on the women and they were just taking them out of the ward and giving them a needle of some sort and then shoving them back in. Of course, at that point, they were not exactly these were women who already had a history of behavior problems, and you give them a needle, and that doesn't make their behavior any better.
Mike, just if you would hang on for half a second, I want to bring Fred in and just do a little geographical check here. Fred, when Michael describes your life, it's in the boys' dormitory or the boys' home, and your fear of, what was it, Ward 22?
Yes, that was the prison on the grounds.
Was that the East Building or where?
Yeah, no, that's called Ward 22. It was, maybe a block from the BH, which was boys' home. And it was every bit of a hardcore prison. It had bars on the windows, it had cells in it. And when you'd run away from the school, they'd put you in the cells and shave your head and stuff like that, just like a regular prison. But I'm interested in what this last guest said about they're giving them injections. See, when we were at the BD and BH, when they did experiments, they didn't just do the radiation. We feature all that because it's documented. They did experiments there, and I keep saying that they ought to check in and find out what else they did. And he brings up a point where they injected them. What did they inject them with? What were the big brown pills they gave us one time in the day room, which had nothing to do with the science club? So I got a feeling that this was like a laboratory for experiments, and
it was more
deeper
than
into it.
It was more than that, in a sense, because we always would have the doctors parading through the place, looking at the microcephalic and other kinds of defective, you know, examples that we had there. There was a storage. There was a building full of brains that had, brains of defective people that
laboratory,
were studied.
Laboratory, yes. I worked.
I mean,
there, yeah.
I also helped get Beryl Cohen, who helped file the suit that eventually results in the consent decree, that added a lot of staff and provided for resources that institution never dreamed of.
There's, in fact, one of the characters in Michael D'Antonio's book, who Joey, I think it is, Michael, who has the job of slicing the brains for the doctors.
It was actually considered a point of honor that he'd be functional enough to be hired for the lab and given this task of slicing brains so that they could be viewed in section as transparencies in microscopes or through overhead projection. One of the points that's also been made by one of the callers is that the employees, the students or residents of the institution were relied upon for their labor. You know, they would take care of more disabled patients because the state just didn't pay enough money and budget enough money to have adequate staffing. And without the forced labor of the residents, the institution would have fallen apart.
Now, Joey goes back to the Fernald School after it's closed and finds these jars of brains that he had to handle as a boy.
It's a remarkable thing. There are actually, I believe the number is 50,000 slides of brain tissue. They're just sitting unguarded, really, in a library at the institution now. It's actually considered one of the world's greatest resources for the study of neurological tissue, macabre as it sounds. And there were fetuses in jars there, organs in jars, and this was the environment that boys worked in. You can imagine how terrified they were. The attendants would say, if you're not careful, you're going to wind up in one of Dr. Benda's pickle jars. And they knew that meant, well, you'd be dissected.
You were there as well, Fred?
Oh, yes. Well, I worked there for a short time. I was cleaning the tubes, the special tubes that they had. They had a couple of gals in there, scientists, I believe, that were studying something there. They worked there, and they were studying probably the brain slides, you know. And, it was scary.
One of the more grotesque events happened in the 1980s when someone was cleaning out a storage area and they discovered two cylinders, and inside the cylinders were two human heads. And they traced them to the Spanish Civil War, and apparently they had been imported as biological specimens for study at Fernald, and whoever had done the work apparently left them behind.
We're going to take our next call from Ayer, Massachusetts. Cindy's with us. Hi, Cindy.
Hi. I worked in this field for quite a while with deinstitutionalized adults, and one of our trainings was in something called social role valorization theory, which I thought was really interesting. And
what does it mean?
Well, basically what it means is that when someone is devalued, particularly in our society, it means that they're going to be treated badly. And various examples were given in our training. It was a three-day training, and it involved the elderly, and it certainly involved people with disabilities. And when the author spoke about how this had so much momentum and it wasn't stopping, it just seems to me to be much bigger an issue, a bigger cultural, even economic issue.
Are you saying, Cindy, that that same link between devaluing people and treating them badly is as much a part of the institutions that are still in our society?
Yeah, oh, absolutely. That's why we're constantly cutting our budgets for these people right off the bat. I mean, they're not contributing to society. They're taking away from society, and so they're devalued. People are only valued in our culture if they're working and producing and making money. And if they need care and they need a little help, well, then we don't value them very much, do we? We don't want to take the time and the money to do that, even though there could be a real pearl in the rough there, as is the case with your guest, Fred, who I congratulate.
Fred, what do you make of that? That what Cindy's saying, that this still goes on to an extent that there are...
I think so. I think they need to, look into it more and see and make sure that this is not really prevalent. And they need to give more funds to take care of these people. You know, I was reading in the USA Today that they're putting them in these detention homes, these the mentally ill people, and they're throwing them in there, and because they don't have enough of money for the to take care of them medically. So it's really something, I'll tell you.
Fred, we are out of time. I want to thank you so much for taking time out of your day to be with us on the program today.
Okay, I want to say that it is often said of the media is the eyes of the common, and the common folk needs good eyes. Thank you so much. And Michael, I want to play golf with you. I'll give you a couple of strokes. You've been promising me.
Okay,
I'll
Fred.
See you later. Thank you so much.
That's Michael D'Antonio, who is the author of a book we've been discussing this hour. It's called The State Boys Rebellion. Michael, thanks a lot for your time as well. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.